Bumblebee, Bumblebee, Bee. Welcome to the Immersed Podcast. We are your hosts, Alex O'Keefe and Dan Ramsden. We are also founders of Immersed Recovery, where we are building the home of recovery for everyday and world-class athletes.
We aim to immerse you in education via our guests, bring communities together, embrace positive change, and help create solid habits that yield the path for our health and longevity.
Right, here we go.
And that's the only reason I think I had to do this, because if I'm going to express my miraculous story, they think, oh, it's some crazy woman going on about being near end of life and everything. But the fact that I'm a scientist as well as a doctor, as well as a holistic practitioner, as well as a yogi and spirit, that I've gone out there to learn all this. Yeah. So then I can put it all together and it makes sense, you know. Yeah. I've had to put a patch over it now because I'm, but it's fine because I... believe that instead of sort of sitting there going, oh my God, I've got it, I think, no, this is my anger coming out and this makes sense. And yes, it's going to be a scar and I love my neck and it's just like, but it doesn't matter because if we can get it better with the wound healing, then that's another scar. And I'm proud of it. You know, I'm really proud of my mastectomy scar. I'm proud of this scar because it defines me. So many people try and disguise it and have a reconstruction or whatever. But I think, no, I'm proud of my scars, you know, because they define me and how amazing my body has been on this journey. I don't want to disguise these things, you know.
Yeah, fair play.
If everyone could have your perspective on it, then, you know, be much...
Oh, you guys are so sweet.
I think 95% of people wouldn't have survived.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think like...
Because of the mindset.
Yeah, well, for example, I feel really sorry about Sarah Harding.
Are we on?
Yeah, but we're not.
Yeah, but stuff. Like, for example, poor Sarah Harding, they told her, they offered her radio. I wasn't offered that, but they offered her radiotherapy because she obviously had breast cancer and it was, it was during COVID, so she didn't go and seek help. And then obviously by the time she was diagnosed, it was very advanced. But they said to her that the radiotherapy would probably keep her alive for maybe a few more months, but to her, she decided not to go for it because for her as a celebrity, she's defined by her hair and her looks. And the fact that she thought, you know, she's told, I mean, I don't know obviously how advanced and everything all of that was, but it's so sad that she wasn't given some hope, you know, you know, how can we know that it's going to be 4 months or 5 months? I've loads of people who've been diagnosed and given poor prognosis and they're living through that, you know. So if you don't have that... You know, because what you think the doctor's saying is everything, it isn't necessarily. And I say that as a doctor myself, because if I listened to the doctor, they said I was dying. They got everything in place. Mm. Sorry, I must be quite now zipping. But that's what it's just because I have got an amazing group of friends that really are amazing. And the fact that they made me think, and I thought about it as well, and I thought, yeah, I can do this. And my family were phenomenal coming in and helping, you know, like they did. But the problem is they're all my family are medically trained, but we're the first line of doctors, really. My dad got us training because you know, we're from a family of watchmakers, which I think is hilarious. You know, we're the colonial watch repairers in India. They used to repair the stopwatches of the colonies. Mm. And then my dad, when he was very young, his younger brother died of typhoid. Mm. And basically, my great-grandfather, as in his their grandfather, was absolutely devastated. And he says, never again. So this is 1940s India. This is what I'm writing in my book. And he then said, there will always be a doctor in the family because we didn't know what was going on and we were helpless. Yeah? Yeah. And we just don't want that. So what my dad was quite happy to be an engineer, you know, not an engineer, just to be an office clerk. That's what he wanted to do. And he loved botany, he loved space travel, he loved all that. And he wanted to be a pilot, actually, funnily enough. Yeah. But his eyesight wasn't good enough, so that's why he had to then. But my great-grandfather saved all his life so he could send my dad to medical school. And my dad had to do one degree, a botany degree, before he was allowed into medical school. So it's amazing that he did all of that. And then he obviously came to England to get his... but then he made me and my sister the same. And I thought to myself, if I had been there, my sister, my brother-in-law, for example, he's a Max Vax surgeon. If they hadn't come, they wouldn't have given me the radiotherapy and I would have died. Mm. There's just no two ways about it. They had to fight and fight when I was very vulnerable. But this makes me sad because I think, well, what about the layperson? They haven't got anyone to fight for them or know that insight. So for my friends and for other people, I'm always there as their doctor to give them advice, you know, because to me, they're my family. So I'm happy to help anybody because that's what my essence is. But it makes me sad that if I hadn't got my family, I wouldn't be here. I know that because they had to really push for me to have radiotherapy. They didn't want to give it to me. This is my whole brain because I had spread in my brain and everything.
Do you think that the general health service needs to have more empaths? Because I just don't feel like there's enough of it. You know, the stories that you hear. And things that I've experienced personally as well and other stories of people that are close.
Yeah.
And it just seems like it's all very statistic-based.
I completely agree with you, but then I can see it from the other side because I know the pressure we are all under. Because when we went to medical school, most of us went because of a need to help others. But the system erodes that away from you. And the fact that there's not enough time, you know. I got sick and I know I was leading a very healthy life. I would go exercising, do everything, but it was my stress that got me, you know, because I was living in a constant 10 years of high level stress because you've got 60 patients to see. You've got 10 minute slots. I can't do people in 10 minutes. I just can't, you know, I can't just give them something and off they go. I don't know which person came up with a 10 minute idea because you know, sometimes patients don't need drugs. They just want someone to look at them, listen to their story, reassure them. But that takes time to educate and, you know. So I think personally...
Build rapport as well. That takes a little bit of time,
too. It does, yes. The rapport, because they have to first trust you and they feel like, they can, you know. But the thing is, I used to have lots of patients come to see because I did spend this time. But I think, basically... they're very good doctors out there, but the problem is I think a lot of doctors became into self-survival mode because the only way you can survive is saying, right, okay, even not looking at it, here's a prescription off
in the boxes.
Yes, it is, because the thing is, if you don't do that, you get ill, and that's what happened to me, you know? So it's almost like a protection because the system hasn't... The governments, all the governments, have not funded the NHS properly. They are trying to privatise it. That, I mean, that's between, you know... But this is the case, you know, you can ask people. And you can see already a lot of people going for private healthcare stuff. Yeah. And the problem is, for me, I think... education should start at grassroots level. So you're teaching children about good nutrition, about exercise, about meditation and mindfulness. If you start very early on and that's part of their education curriculum, then you won't have people getting ill, you know, and stuff. And then what they should do is all the governments of all parties and the doctors and the healthcare assistants and the whole hospital, all the staff, the nurses, they should all get together and the public, you know, and they select certain people. And what they should do is they should discuss like a 25, 30-year plan for the NHS where it doesn't matter who's governing. They have a fixed plan for growth and how to help the civilization, you know, because NHS is great, but it's not great at the moment because it's, you know, people are burnt out. They're exhausted. They're going off sick. You know, I've had to leave the NHS and that was so dear to me, but it's made me sick twice. So now I've got the message now because I know it's
the universe is showing you.
I mean, it took me 7 years to get into medical school, and you'd think someone was telling me upstairs that's not a good thing for me, but I still went like you know, because I wanted to please my father. But this is what I mean. They are so time restricted. It's horrible. You don't have time to go for a pee even, or you know, anything, or drink, you know. And if you're living like that constantly, and especially some people who are very empathic, you know, there's a level spectrum of empathy, you know, and if you're very empathic, you really feel. And, you know, like my father used to say, you treat every, because I was really nervous about being a doctor. I thought, Dad, I'm, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do. And I might kill somebody or something, you know. And he says, Sumi, you're going to be a wonderful doctor. He says, because you really care about people. And he says, and the most important thing is you see them as your family. That was a good piece of advice, but also bad, because then I felt like I've got all my grandmas visiting, all my sisters, brothers. Yeah, and I thought, oh my God, you know, it's like bad enough when you're having a chat with your family and they're grieving. But then when 60 patients are all my family members, it just, I got really involved, you know, and I got really involved in their lives. And in a way, I didn't know about boundaries then. I didn't know about energy and all of that stuff, which I've learned now, but I can't help it. I just, you know, one of my friends said, why do you, even in hospital, I even ran clinics while I was in hospital dying, because they'd all come and see me and they say, you're so happy all the time. And I was like giving them little clinics, because, you know, like one of the nurses came and said to me, Sooms, you know, this poor healthcare assistant is really stressed, do you mind having a chat with her? I said, oh my God, it'll be a pleasure. So she came in the evening and I was sleeping then. And then she was just sitting there waiting for me to wake up. And it was about 2 a.m. and I opened my eyes and I went, oh, hello. And she said, oh, hi. She says, I'm Sarah. And I said, well, let me have a... So you have anxiety. Well, let's talk about it. And then I said, so you've got to focus on your breath and you've got to start meditating. And I gave her some few little things and some homeopathic remedies and stuff. And then like a few days later, the nurse comes and says, Sumi, well done. She's really happy and she feels, and I only spent like 10-15 minutes, and people say, why do you do that? I said, if someone had come to me when I was a little girl, I lived in severe anxiety with heart palpitations because I was so badly bullied, you know, but in a way that gave me empathy because I knew what it was like to be bullied, you know, Asian 1970s Britain, not a good place, you know, and the only one in the class who's got black hair, you know, I'd put talcum powder on my hair to lighten it. I'd have turmeric taints and people would say, oh, you smell. So I didn't know how to put perfume on. So I drank Mum's Chanel No. 5, half a bottle, just so that I smelt better. So all of these, because I didn't know, you know, you're a little girl, you don't know. And then fortunately I had a positive, so I had my imaginary world and that's where I lived. And I'm writing this all in my book, but I'm writing about my context of why I became the person I am today. And I have that empathy. But yeah, so, you know, it really traumatizes you because people don't realize that there's a brilliant study called the ACE study, the Adverse Childhood Event Study. It's a scientific study where they looked at about quite a lot of people and basically saw even things like being losing your first love or not being having unrequited love can be so traumatic to you that it scars you for the rest of the, and it makes you more you know, because people immediately think traumas like domestic abuse, of course there's that and the sexual abuse and all that kind of stuff, but simple things like being bullied, what seems simple things, you know, losing your first love, you know, breaking up, all of that kind of stuff can be just as traumatic.
And reshape
your whole life. Trajectory in life.
We talked a little bit in the car on the way up, and you spoke a little bit about anger.
Yes.
And I do not feel that from you.
Yes.
You know, we go back a few years
we
now.
Do, and we do,
we've
Dan.
Reconnected
yeah,
again.
We do.
Which is great.
Yeah.
You know, it's been really nice to see you again. You've been on one hell of a journey.
Yeah.
But you've come to a different place now, and I don't ever associate anger with you.
Neither do I.
can you speak a little,
yes,
bit, a little bit about that? And
yes, of course.
You know, what was it that you were suppressing, and then what were the process of you healing?
Yeah, I think anger is a really interesting emotion because I wasn't aware. I feel anger, but I never express it. Yeah, all through my life. So like, for example, when I was a little girl, I remember I won an art competition. Actually, art was the only subject I got an A in. Everything else was like, you know, by the by. But I got A in, you know, I got an art. I was about 7 or 8 and I'd won this art competition. And this boy came up to me and he said he'd come third. And he says, you do know that third is so much better than being first. And I sat there and I thought about it and I thought, oh gosh, well, you know, obviously I'm no good. And I thought, oh, yeah, okay then. And then afterwards I sort of went off and I got a bit angry. I thought, I'm sure first is better than third. But, you know, when you're about eight and he was like really bully, he says, you know, blackies don't do well in art. You know, you're just, you know, they, oh, and even the teacher used to bully me. It was really bad. Wow. Yeah, yeah. And because in that time, I think the racial prejudice thing hadn't come. I think it was just recently they recognised it, because until that point they hadn't really recognised. I think 1968 or something, that's when the thing came in thing, but it wasn't practised really. So this is, we're talking about the late 1970s when I was like a little girl. But I got angry, but I didn't dare and express it because I just thought, oh, I'm sure that's not right, you know. But then I just repressed it, because that meant there was no confrontation. And I just said, yeah, you're probably right. You know, and I thought he probably was right. You know, maybe they got this wrong, you know, and that I hadn't really won this art competition. But that, you know, people, the power of the mind is phenomenal. Like they did a trial in Harvard where they had a circle of people and they had two lines and one was much longer than the other. And that, and they had 11 people who knew that were in it. Just one person wasn't. And they all said, they said, which is the longer line? And they all said the shorter one was the longer line. And this other guy was like looking around, you know, thinking, you know, scratching his head. Yeah. But then when it came to him, he went, yeah, 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 that one's the longer line. Because he started to doubt, even though it's so obvious, he started to doubt his own thing that everyone was saying that. So that's the power
of the mind.
Yeah, that's the power of the mind. And so when that boy had said that to me, I thought, yeah, I'm shit, I'm crap. Yeah. You know, I can't do that. He's right. But then I got a bit angry. I thought, that's not fair. And then when I wanted to be an air hostess and Dad said, you've got to be a doctor. And I thought, my God, you know, I'm not intelligent by any means. And how am I going to do that? You know, and I thought, I just want to be an air hostess. I want to help people, but I want to do it in a way which is not so scary, you know, with blood and guts and whatever have you. But, you know, and then when my parents used to argue, I used to get upset about that and angry, but then I didn't experience it because I didn't let myself experience it. So what happens? It just gets embedded into the body and it sits there. So I've got all my life's anger steeped away inside. Yeah. And so, yeah, that's quite powerful, you know, and because you don't recognize it as an emotion. And I met one of my really good friends, and it's so funny how everything is serendipitous, that things start to happen when you think of something, like, you know, like we were talking about, like, the pop band, you know, and we've all been talking about it. It's just sort of weird because I've just, you know, discovered them just recently. But
I think that's consciousness as well, isn't it?
Yes, you know, that is consciousness.
You've got to be kind of aware as well.
Yes, you have to have that consciousness.
Yeah, a lot of people are just oblivious and they're just kind of just taking all the data in and not actually thinking about
it. Yeah, exactly. Like today I saw a bird flying and I thought, wow, that's amazing that this little thing can fly, you know, and you know, the blackbirds, well, the crows are a bit fatter, but I think, my God, and the seagulls, how do they get themselves up there, you know? It's phenomenal. And it's just, you know, but what I was saying, this is what I tend to go off on. Yeah, so it's the anger and it's deep inside. And I met one of my friends and it just so happened that he didn't express anger because we're at medical school together, and he was trying to come out at that time in the first year, and all the guys were really bullying him. And I don't remember this, but he said to me, you were so kind to me, I'll never forget that, and now I'm here to give you some further advice. So we'd been talking about various people who are really good at, like, talking about healing, neuroscientist, I think Dr. Joe Dispenza, he was talking about, and he introduced me to him and got me to get the course, so I'm working my way through that as well. Awesome. But he says, you're doing all of the stuff anyway, Sumi, but I think if you do his course, you're going to finally nail it, sort of thing. But then we'd both were meeting in Victoria to go to Brighton. This is just a couple of weeks ago. And then he, and I'd been to like a famous coffee chain just to get my little matcha latte and my croissant. And then he came 10 minutes later with a little, the same thing in his, and he was fuming. And I went, wow, I never seen you so angry. And he says, you know, Sumi, I was queuing up and then this guy just butted in and just literally pushed me aside, you know, and he says, no one's ever been so rude to me. So I got so angry and I just started effing and blinding, you know, trying to be polite, but, you know, and then I said, God, that's so unlike you. And then he says, yes. And he says, I'm angry at being angry. And I said, But, you know, it's funny you say that because I'm processing anger at the moment. And one of the things I've realised is society makes us feel that anger is bad. But actually, it's why have we been produced with anger as an emotion in our emotional spectrum? It's very important. Mm-hmm. And it's very important to express that anger instead of repress it, which we tend to do. And yes, sometimes you don't want that confrontation, but you don't have to shout at the person. You can go off and journal away and go in a forest and vent, but you have to let it out in some form or other. Yeah. Because if you don't, what happens is it builds up. And the day, so when I had the radiotherapy treatment, they were giving me some complimentary Reiki, and this, which is energy healing, basically. And what happened was this woman saw me and she said, "It's amazing all the work you've done." As I was saying, "You've really released a lot of emotions." But she says, "Do you know what?" She says, "You've got some serious anger in you." And I went, "What?" And I was even surprised. I just couldn't believe it. And then she says, "Yeah, it's there." And within like a few minutes, usually when I meditate, I see purple and green. That's when you're on a spiritual kind of that kind of vortex that you get after you've meditated for a long time.
The colours have different meanings.
Yes, the colours have different meanings. Yeah, yeah. Yes, like the purple's like the crown chakra, the green is the heart chakra. But when she'd done what she did on me, I just suddenly, she says, "What do you see?" I said, "You've destroyed my colours." I said, "It's all mud now, it's red." She says, "Good." And I said, "What do you mean?" She says, "Red is the colour of anger and it's your sacral, it's your root chakra." She said, "It's coming out." And I said, "It looks like mud. It looks like you've put mud in my whole vision." Mm-hmm. And she said, "Good, it's coming out now." And do you know what it felt like? It felt like I'd been to Highgate
Cemetery. Was that sadness? Did it feel sad to you?
No, it's very interesting. It was anger. Yeah, it came out.
So you felt angry in the moment?
Yes. I felt real anger after I left because I started to type my book, but instead of I started to type 2 pages on anger and how angry I was about this, that, the other. And I couldn't believe it, just flowing from my fingers. And I thought, oh my God, my fingers are just taking control.
So that's actually one of the tools to release the anger is typing it onto the page.
To journal, write, express to your really close friends. But you don't want to have that hallmark of someone you've said something to and then they have that idea of that person because you don't want to colour that. So sometimes it's a more healthier thing to maybe write or maybe confide in a really close friend who you know you can trust and then vent in the forest. I vented a poor swan with its signet. And do you know it's crazy? The swan's like looking at me and I'm like, "You're going around the woods." It was just like crazy. But anyway, I wrote like all this kind of stuff. And then I'd been, as I said, to Highgate Cemetery the day before, and I don't know whether you've been there, but it's an amazing cemetery if you ever get a chance to go there. George Michael's buried there, and near him is that Russian, who's that guy, Livenko. Yes, I can't pronounce Russian very well. I can do Dostoevsky, Dania, but that's it. And basically his wife Sasha really wanted to make a statement, so they buried him at Highgate Cemetery. So as soon as we were on this tour, and they said everyone started to move away from the grave because obviously we knew he had radiation. But then they said they kept in don't worry, he's in a lead-lined coffin, because they have to keep the radiation, in there. And when I was writing my book, writing my anger thing, I just said, it's like a lead-lined coffin. That's so putrid because it's had all my anger from all my life. It's almost like the bolts are like coming out now, it can't hold it in anymore. And it's spewing out, and it's so funny because when this lymph node came up, I'd really repressing a lot of the anger by that stage because you get treated differently because of what you've got. And you think, I'm still Sumi, I could still do this. But just little things, where I think, some people don't have the empathy that, say, I would have if my friend or my family member was sick, But it's so funny because when the lymph node came up, I thought, that's interesting. This is your throat chakra. It's your expression. And it's funny. It's come up there now, And it had actually what we call a necrotic center. So its center was dying. And that came up, you know, and it was really interesting for me to recognize that. And then after I'd done that, I have cacao, like it's which is a really beautiful drink from South America, originated in South America, and it's very good for your healing. It's got theobromine in and some really good essential nutrients for healing. But when I started to take that one day, I just suddenly felt really sick with it. And it's the same formula I use, and I ended up throwing up. So it's almost like I was releasing my anger, like the brown, through that. And then the next day, I did poopy-poos, you know, and I thought, that was brown. And I thought, what's going on, you know? And I thought, it's like, it's detoxing, because what happens is you're detoxing. Yeah, you're purging. Mm-hmm. And that's what they say in Ayurveda. Like, they have a thing when you do detox, they say you feel awful. And I felt awful.
What is Ayurveda, just for anyone?
Ayurveda is basically the traditional Indian system of medicine. And it's basically roughly translated to the science of life. Yeah, so that's what it is. It looks at people's constitution. So, for example, it puts you into, you know, like we are nature. Yeah, we are nature. We are made of five elements. Yeah, the fire, obviously, which is your digestion, the air, which is the breath that you take in, the water, which is the blood circulation in you, the circulation in you, and then the ether, which is the space, and that's a space for opening your breath, opening your mind to the subconscious, yeah? And then the other one is, I did ether, air, space, water, and earth. That's your bones, that's your solidity, that's your organs, yeah? But the thing is, we're all made of different amounts of thing. And you can tell, like I can look at you and I can tell which element is more predominant in you, yeah? Because
what do you think then? Go
well, I can looking at you, you've got quite a long face. I mean, just generally, look at it, but you are very a sensitive individual, but and you're more like air and ether, so you have access to spirituality, but you have to be careful that you don't overdo things because then if you overdo them, you get tired and your energy is lost. You know, so and for someone like you, you're like me, Vata Pitta. Vata is air and ether, Pitta is fire and water, and Kapha is earth and water. So you can say by just hearing them which the person will be more stable. So when I look at Kennedy, I can see she's got water and earth, she's a stable force, you know, to be, you know, she's very kind, empathic. You have to get her to do exercise. She doesn't necessarily want to do it, but, you know. but she is going to be rock solid in terms of, someone you can really trust, who's almost a mother figure, you know, like really caring. Doesn't get like stressed, but it's very calm, but she does worry internally, but she might not necessarily express it. I mean, that's what I can just tell. And she's
pretty bang
but that's from what I can see, you know. But she, because with a Kapha person, they've got a very nice round face, they're very comforting. So people like Oprah Winfrey, Obama's wife, Michelle Obama, they're very like rounded, very nice, very stable influences in someone's life, but they will get imbalanced if they start to not do their exercise, start to eat like really heavy foods. That's not good for them. They're much better having lighter foods and eating maybe twice a day and doing a lot of HIIT and all that kind of stuff, because they need to get their metabolism moving. Like for me, for example, because I'm Vata, I used to love running a lot, you know, and that actually made me worse, because it made the air and the space really go fast in me. So I came back and I'm really anxious, and being Vata, you're very anxious prone, you know, you're like, oh, you, because you're fast moving all the time, you know, and so I've now slowed my exercise down and I feel so much better. So I exercise still, but I do it for my constitution. But that's what's beautiful about Ayurveda, because it teaches you that everyone says, oh, yes, you should do this exercise. Everyone should do it. But it's not right for everybody.
Yeah.
And also the right food as well.
And that changes. You have to adapt.
Yes, you have to adapt, yeah. And so, like, for example, I know that I need to have more soups and stews because I haven't got enough water and earth in me like Kennedy has, you know. So I have to accommodate that with my food. I oil myself twice a day and the oil gets absorbed just like that. But then my friend, Jamie, he did, he said, God, the oil's been soaked in. And I gave the same oil to him and it wouldn't even soak because he's got a lot of fire in him. And the fire is the people who, and we all have all the elements within us, but there's predominance of some. So you will have air and ether because obviously you're breathing and you're thinking, but you're grounded. Yeah. I'm not so grounded. So I have to ground myself. Like you've got angular jaw, so you've got ambition. There's a bit of ambition there. Mm. You know, that's the fire in you. Yeah, yeah. You know, you want to get that done. You want to create. And if you look at life in general, so you have to avoid spicy foods and
hot foods.
Yeah, because that'll upset your tummy, you know, because you've already got enough fire in there. You don't need any more, you know. But then you'll have, and then you can see that's pitta, so they're fire, and they're 90% fire and 10% water. So that's the predominance. So you'll see people with pitta red faces, you know, and they've got like, they'll tend to have acne, and they'll be a bit more angry, you know, they'll be the one, oh, why aren't you doing it like this, you know, and then you think, oh, you know. But the thing is, that's your constitution, that's what you're born with. So you're either vata pitta, extremes of how do you manage that kind of thing. But people who are tritoshic, which means that they're evenly balanced on all three tushas, are pretty, I think my mum is, you know, she's very good. She's very calm, but then she's also has the ambition, but then she's very spiritual. So she's almost got all three of them in equal. So I would probably say I'm 40% air and ether. So I'm 40% vata, probably about 50% vata, 40% pitta, so ambition, obviously, to get where I did, and then maybe 10% kapha. So I have to nurture my kapha, nurture my water. I have to make sure I'm well hydrated. Mm. I'm eating protein, good foods to solidify me, you know? Mm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Does.
It's phenomenal, yeah. Isn't it?
What's interesting, when we first met again, yes, at the train station,
yes,
you said that I looked younger. Now, yes, when we met originally,
yes,
I was going through a stressful time,
yeah,
and I was going through divorce,
yes, yeah,
and that didn't turn out too good,
yeah,
for me,
yes.
It's all good now,
yeah, you know, good.
Line in the sand, move forward,
good.
Part of the anger, I went back to play rugby,
yes,
and I'd not played for 14 years,
yeah.
I didn't know if I could still do it, I didn't know if my body could handle it,
yeah.
But I signed up for the season, and what I noticed is it was the most present that I'd been in years.
Years, yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. Years. Yeah. Because the only thing that we're focusing on is catching the ball, setting the players up, and hitting people hard.
Yes, yes,
and
yeah.
And it was great. It was great. I needed that.
Yes,
I really
you did.
And,
yes,
and,
yeah.
And, you know, to replicate that and then to do it again, I don't have that drive anymore.
Yeah,
I've literally done it.
You've got it out.
I went back as an older player, put it all out there, and then I knew when the season had finished, I'm done with that now.
Yeah,
I don't need to go back again.
It's a phenomenal thing when you release your anger. And I feel now, just from all the things that I've had, and this is the final thing, it's almost like a little ulcer that's developed here because it's really letting everything out now. But I feel like, I feel so much lighter. I'm sleeping better. I can't believe this lady did this. And within like a week, I can feel the massive difference. And my relationships have changed with people who I've been angry with. They're like suddenly really being, you know, and I'm just like, not, I've got no anger. Mm. And it's just all gone, you know. Mm. And that is, and I think that is why I had to have this, all of this happen, because now it's given me space inside to properly heal, because I thought, I'm healing a lot. I mean, I've got no mets in my chest now, my mets, you know, my cancer spread from my brain's gone all down, everything, but it's not healed completely, you know. And you can have spinal mets for many years and survive, but the fact is, still not quite gone. And I now can let all the spirituality in, because I'm now a pretty much empty vessel. But before that, just before I saw her again, and it's interesting you say about depression and sadness, because I was doing my morning routine And then suddenly I had this, like, oh, you know, I had to, like, suddenly start meditating. And I just suddenly saw just black, you know. And suddenly this black broke and it just became like blackbirds all flying off. And then it exposed like a peach red colour. And then I told my Reiki lady that, and she said, they definitely flew off. I said, yeah, the blackbirds flew off. She said, they didn't land. I said, no. She says, right, that's what you've done. She says, in order for your anger to properly come out, there was a big, thick layer of depression on top of it because you felt sad about the way you'd been treated and the fact you couldn't express your anger. So it was keeping it all in, like the lead-lined coffin. So it was like the lead-lined coffin, really. But the fact that it broke, it's now finally letting everything release. And you suddenly realise that it's the people who have upset you. It's not their fault. It's your reaction to them. And when you realise that, because you're angry, I mean, you can't, you know, you shouldn't have expectations of people. And because I had certain expectations, it was almost like I was caging myself when that expectation wasn't met. So you are actually, it's your reaction. And that was a big drop, you know, like, the penny really dropped. Then I thought,
acceptance
that I love them, I forgive them, you know, because unless you do that, you cannot heal, you cannot move on, you know. And that fact that it's your reaction, and it's not your fault either, because it might be you're a child or whatever, but the fact that you can be aware of it now, and so when you do feel angry, you go off to the swan and the cygnet or wherever you're going to vent or journal, then it's a much more healthy release, because it's one of our emotions. But the thing is, I was taught it was a bad emotion, you know, it's not normal, and that's why it was repressed.
So just for the listener then, I'm thinking of someone who, you know, if they're not feeling quite right at the moment, it could be a physical thing, it could be a mental thing. What action would you suggest? I know it's very broad and it's very general.
No,
but what,
I think,
what sort of advice would you know, if you've got a bit of an intuition that something's not quite right with you?
Right, yes. I think,
where do you go?
Well, I think obviously your instinct is amazing. You know, it is just the most valuable thing you have. And I think people always looking outside to get help, but actually all the knowledge and information is inside of you. But you have to get to a certain level to be able to realize that. But I think certainly if you start doing regular meditations, like just 5 minutes even, just, you know, there's lots of things out there on the internet that you can use, just focusing on your breath, just focusing on the present moment, just, you know, leaving the past, leaving the present, and it will take time because your mind will start racing.
How do you set that situation up for yourself?
Well, I think, first of all, you journal, and first of all, you gratitude is amazing. It almost recircuits your brain. So first thing is not to see the negative. So write down, say, and you can't think of any gratitude. I'm really glad I've got two eyes that can see. I'm really glad that I'm alive and breathing. I'm really glad that I've got a really supportive family. By doing that, you've already reframed it in your head and in your neurobiochemistry. And then to actually say, right, so I'm really grateful for all of these things. And then you can say, but this is making me sad. You can then start journaling about how you feel and talk as if you're talking to a therapist, but you're just letting it all out onto a piece of paper. So you're letting your inner feelings out, which you feel like can't be expressed. Because in this culture that we are, I mean, it's getting better, but we are very stiff upper lip. You know, we don't like to express. When people ask, how are you? And you say, I'm fine. You might not be fine, but it's a waste of energy to ask that question, because even before they've replied, you're already walked off. But in Italy, for example, oh my goodness, I didn't realise this. I asked one of my friends, I said, how are you? Then he tells me his whole story about his marriage and all of what's going on. I thought, oh gosh, I wasn't expecting that. But the thing is, when you ask how are you, they'll tell you how they are, and they'll tell you the truth, you know, and it might be a long story.
I must be Italian then.
Yeah. I said, well, do you really want, okay, so, and then I'll tell another story to get to the other story, and then they said, what was the story, what was the answer, you know. But the thing is, that's the thing, it's our culture, and because I'm Indian as well as British, because I was born and bred here, I find it very amusing. I was just even saying, talking about the timekeeping, like, you know, like how my family were time colonial watch repairers, and how always my British friends will be 10 minutes early. And I think, why are you early? I'm not ready yet. And then my Indian friends will be 10 minutes late. And I thought, oh, I love you guys. You give me, you know, I'm going to do this balance, makeup or whatever. Yeah, it's just really funny. And, you know, it just makes me laugh. So when my friend is saying they're going to come, I thought, okay, so my friend Ruth is going to come and visit me tomorrow. And I thought, she'll come on time, so I better be ready on time. But 5 minutes early. But if it's my other friend, I think, oh yeah, 15 minutes, it's okay. We can just lace our time. So it's really funny. It makes me laugh.
It's just so refreshing. And this is the first time I've met you.
Oh, thank you.
Came to the train station, had a big embrace, and I just feel your energy straight away. And I just think, you know, that's beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
But it's so refreshing to see someone like yourself who's actually a professional, who's giving advice and not thinking about profit, not thinking about, you know, what you're going to gain. You're literally giving pure advice to help human beings. And I think when we think about it, it's just the basics. I heard you speak earlier and you said, you know, we're advising this person, I was telling her to breathe. And that's what it's all about, and it's just basic human functions that can actually help.
Do you know, it's amazing you say that, because I'm first of all very humble, so thank you, Alex. But when I was in hospital, when I went in as end of life, I remember being put on a ward, and I was by myself in this ward, and it was that March, that spring, just before Easter. Do not go into hospital at Easter. That's one advice I'll tell all your listeners. But I was in this room, and it was hailing. It was snowing that particular Easter, you know, and no one was coming and everything. And I just thought, God, this is really hard, you know, being given this diagnosis and then left over Easter weekend. And, you know, it would be nice if someone came, and the nurses are so busy, everyone's really busy, and I didn't want to disturb anybody, you know. I thought, I'm all right, I've got this, you know. But you know, I've just been given my diagnosis then and everything. But I just thought, you know what, I mean, wow, this is me, and I'm a doctor, and this is how I'm being treated. So what would the layperson be being treated like? And all my friends had been telling me that this is how it's, but I never realised, because the thing is, when my father was a doctor back in the 70s and 80s, he was a very caring, you know, the doctor, there'd be a doctor on call 24/7, but the NHS was a very different place then. And I was still in that vision of how it was then, you know, and their skills, detective skills, were superb. Dad loved detective stories, and he said being a doctor is like being a detective. But the modern way we've become, I think the art of medicine has been lost. People come in and they say, oh, we'll have a scan here and we'll have a thing there and whatever. I mean, I've been having repeated scans, obviously, to monitor. But the thing is, I'm the one who diagnosed my lymph node, because I felt it, and I thought, I actually examined myself, I thought, this is not right. And I had to go and tell the doctor. And then they said, oh, well, we'll do this test and that test. But the thing is, I think that art, which we're taught very well at medical school, is lost because of the time. And then you become de-skilled and everything like that. So I was in this...
So it becomes more box.
It becomes more, but like, oh yeah, well, you know, you don't need to, we'll do like the red flags, make sure you haven't got, you know, any stumps, and then we'll, but the patients are coming in demanding, I want an MRI. And I remember one patient came and said, I want, you know, because I'm a musculoskeletal doctor as well. That's my interest, the body, the joints and everything. And this patient came in and she said, I really want an MRI, doctor, of the back. And I said, but listen, I've just examined you, and, you know, you haven't got any nerve pathology or anything like that. And she was furious. So she went off and she had a private MRI done. And then she came back, because I said she'd got osteoarthritis. And she came back and she said, this doctor doesn't know what she's talking about. My MRI has shown that I've got degenerative changes. And then I thought, degenerative changes are osteoarthritis. And then I realised that she'd actually taught me a massive lesson, that the language I was using, because at medical school you're tested to such a high degree that you start to use that same language with patients, like, you've got osteoarthritis. And then I realised, so then I really made it simple. I didn't want to patronise people, but actually, I was really surprised, because when people came, I said, it's like a wear and repair arthritis. So I'd talk about the joint, how the lining was wearing down. And people would like, oh, wow, that's... And I said, it's wear and repair, not wear and tear, because the way you use your language can be very powerful. And then that woman taught me that. So I'm so great. I know she was mad and she put a complaint in against me. But the thing is, it made me realise that my language has to be changed as well, because people are coming. They haven't been to medical school for 5 years, so they're not going to know all of this stuff. I remember when I learned about urinary tract infections, I would write it out. Urinary tract. I wrote 4 pages on urinary tract because it was like, wow, what is this? You know. And then people say UTIs, you know, and you think, what's a UTI if you've never? But to me, it's like second nature. Yeah. But then I have to say it's a urine and tract infection, and this is how it happens, and explain it to people. But that takes time, you see. And when you haven't got that time, you're being pressured. That stresses you out. And especially being Vata, air and ether, I get even more stressed. Yeah. So it's learning about that and understanding that.
One of your sayings is knowledge is power.
Knowledge is power. Knowledge absolutely. Is power. Without knowledge, you know, my dad would say, education is power, Sumi. Knowledge is power, because people can say whatever they want to say to you, but you have to go. So, for example, I did the integrative medicine diploma, which is integrative medicine is basically conventional medicine, which is what I was trained in, plus traditional medicine, so things like ancient Indian medicine, Ayurveda, and traditional Chinese medicine, and complementary, so Western herbalism, homeopathy, all of this kind of stuff. These are all part of the puzzle, the holistic puzzle, seeing a human being
like
as a whole, exactly, that they are a human being, that they have feelings, they have emotions, they are a product of their perceptions, the way they've been brought up, the traumas they experience, they perceive to experience, all of that kind of stuff, finances, what they were taught as from their parents, who also were taught by their parents. So there's an ancestral kind of thing, and it's no one's fault. That's the thing. And I think once, because we like to blame people when things go wrong, oh, it's so-and-so's fault. But the thing is, at the end of the day, it's our perception. It's what's inside. You know, we control our reaction. So, you know, like you have to see it in a different way. And I use this. That's another thing I use to help people, the cinema, because I love movies, the cinema analogy, where you, when you're in the cinema, you're watching the video, you're watching the screen, you're really into the story, like, you know, blood and guts or whatever, romantic, whatever, and you're like, oh my God, you know, and you're feeling your heart beats faster when it's scary, and then, you know, and filled with love hormones when someone's kissing, and you're like, oh, so cute, you know. But then you're really into it. Your body's physiology is mirroring what's happening on the screen, yeah? But then you could be a popcorn seller, so you're coming down the aisle and you're like looking at the movie a bit, but then you're still got to do your job, so you're selling the popcorn, so you're a bit removed from it, so you're not so involved in the story. Or if it's still involving you a bit, then you can be the person at the door taking the tickets. You know, you're too busy concentrating on the tickets. So you can do that yourself. And if it's really too bad, just go outside of the cinema.
Just go sell tickets for a while.
Yeah, go sell. So you're almost like seeing yourself in a picture, but you're moving away. Like if you see somebody, say somebody is venting their anger on you. So my energy healer told me this, and I thought this is brilliant. And she said, think of it as a screenplay. So you've gone down to London or wherever, and there's a theatre, and this person has come on the stage, and you're just watching them, and they're venting, like, ah, you know, and you're like, interesting. You know, you're not reacting. Like some people, when they vent, you just want to react. You're like, oh, no, that's not right, you know.
Because you're mirroring.
And, yeah, and, yeah. And so you just sit in there and go, and then I said, oh, can I eat popcorn? She said, you can have some popcorn, which is not good for Vata because it's air and ether, so I have to put lots of butter on it to make it right for me, but that's a good reason. Anyway, so I'm eating my popcorn with ghee, you know, with butter on it, and just watching this person vent. But instead of being, let the person just say what they need to say. So I said, she said, it's like almost like the picture of the screen. So I said, it's not a screenplay, then it's a screenplay. And she went, clever. So, and then imagine that you're the audience watching this person, then another person who's annoying you is doing their venting, and you're like listening, completely removed from it. You're just watching them. And then you're on the screen, you're on the play now, and you're just venting, and you've just got your best friends there, and you're letting it all out. And I think that's such a beautiful way of trying to displace yourself from that situation. Because at the end of the day, guys, we are pretty much insignificant. When you think about the universe and everything like that, our little dramas that we have are insignificant. You know, it's significant at the time to us, but actually when you think about it in the context of stuff. So, for example, you might be having a bad day and then you see someone who's lost their leg on maybe the one show or whatever, and you think, oh God, actually I've got my leg, so I should be, you know, but it's almost like you have to compare to something else in order to feel that, oh, actually I'm all right, I can see, and
to put things in a perspective.
Yeah, it is. It's amazing. And when you actually, like my dad used to always say, you know, Sumi, he says, I know we live in our world and everything, but you think about it, it's like the earth is so minute in the universe. He said it's almost like it's, you know, like you've got beaches and you've got sandy beaches all over our world. He says you're not even a grain of sand. We're so small. We might be just a detectable dust particle on one grain of sand on the whole world. That's how little we are in the terms of the universe. And when you think like that, you think, blooming heck. That's Yorkshire coming out. Blooming heck. The posh accent and then blooming heck. Yeah, but that's, yeah, and that, to me, is phenomenal. And the other thing I learned the other day, which made my jaw drop, is the capacity of your human body. Your human body is pretty much universal, because they said if you take one skin cell and the DNA from that and you stretch it out, it'll be 6 foot tall, okay? So if you take your trillions and billions of cells, you stretch the DNA out, it, if you put it end to end, it would reach the sun and back to Earth 150 times.
What?
That's how much DNA inscription you have got, and that's how much potential you have to change. Oh, but we only use maybe 2% of our DNA. Yeah. So you can refunction, restructure. So like Dr. Joe Dispenza, redefine. For example. Yeah, redefine. So he says, is it your personality that makes your personal reality, or is it your personal reality that makes your personality? That's a heavy question, isn't it? Yeah. But if you think about it, where I'm going through this thing, I realize it is my personality that's creating my personal reality. Yeah. Like I'm here and I'm seeing having cancer as a very positive thing for me, and that's created my reality. So people are interested. They want to learn more. But if I just thought, oh, I'm a victim, this is awful, I'd be in bed now just with a duvet over my head.
Yeah.
Can you see? By restructuring, so if you start to restructure your brain into the future, you know, you hear about people manifesting and the book The Secret and all of that kind of stuff, but you can actually manifest your future by changing your physiology, because your body is quite, it just listens to you. It's your slave, basically, the mind. But the thing is, the problem is the body takes control of the mind. So for example, if you you know, if you sort of say to yourself, like if I tell you, do not under any circumstance, and we did this on the last one, think of a pink elephant drinking champagne. What do you do? Immediately it pops into your head. Because I told you not to think about it. The brain doesn't understand that. Yeah. It if you say do not, it doesn't understand do not. So you have to, like I say in my head, you know, in my brain, I've said, I've healed already. I'm out there giving podcasts. I'm doing talks all over the world. And they're going to even make, and then my friend Dinesh says, they're going to even make a movie. Who are you going to get to star in your movie? I said, maybe Julia Roberts. You know, but I'm thinking like that. And when you think like that, the body starts to think, oh, are we already there then? And it starts to change its neurochemistry, its biochemistry. And so if you, for example, you're living a normal day where you're doing a normal thing, so you'll have the same neurons firing, and the same neurons that fire in the brain wire together. So it'll be that you get up in the morning, you look at your face, you remember who you are, you go for your coffee, then you go to work, and then the same people who trigger you again, and it's the same reaction, the same plasticity, same thing going on and on and on, and you can't change, yeah? So if you start to think, oh, that person's triggering me, how can I deal with this? And say, oh, do you want to come out for a coffee and maybe learn about their lives a bit more? That you've already stopped that neural of, oh my God, that's a person who really can't stand, and, you know, and it fires off and it sends off all the emotions of the stress and everything. So by changing your way of thinking, and you think about, you've got all this DNA that you can actually remodel. Like, for example, genetic disorders, they are only expressed if the environment is perceived as hostile. You know, a lot of mental health conditions and stuff. Why do you think we've got so much trouble now? You know, so it's phenomenal. Our bodies, and my book is basically a scientific love story of the body. I have fallen in love with my body and with everybody's body, because we have all got the same capacity. It's just that most of us, quite a lot of us, live our lives not aware of the amazing amazing world inside of us.
Do you think we're more disconnected than we've ever been?
I do, yeah. Unfortunately, I do, because I think because we're so easily distracted, we've got, you know, I sometimes do it. I'm like doing my meditation and something comes up and then I look it up and then before I know it, an hour has passed. And I thought, where did that hour go? I could have just been doing my meditation. So it's very easy and you have to really be careful. I mean, I think the internet is a phenomenal thing because I've learned a lot of stuff from it, but I have to know where to go to get that information. But equally, I think it's putting a lot of doubt and sadness in a lot of young people, especially because when we were young, you know, I had a lovely idyllic childhood in the sense of, you know, yes, my parents were arguing all that, but with my sister, I remember she used to sit on the back of my bike and we used to go to the strawberry fields and pick strawberries and then she'd eat them and then we'd go to weigh and then the guy would say, shall I weigh your sister because she's got strawberry all over her, you know, to weigh how much you've picked, and she went, oh, you know, sort of thing. But it was just lovely, you know, we didn't have internet, we didn't have to be looking at somebody and think, oh, I want to look like them or whatever, and it was a very idyllic childhood. And in a way, I'm really glad I grew up without a phone. You know, I'm glad I could backpack around the world without it, because you feel almost obliged. Oh, I've got to take a selfie, send it, and you're losing the present moment. And I could only contact my family through internet cafes, and they were great places to hang out. You could find the love of your life in one of those, you know, and you'd be just like internet. And then, sorry, mum, dad, this is the first internet cafe I've come across, and I'll email you. But what a life. It was like free, you know, no one can text you, no one can email you. You're just free spirit, you know, and it's phenomenal. But I think I feel sorry for parents nowadays, because I think it's really hard to try and protect their children from all. And, you know, all the horrible sort of negative media out there that, you know, they're ending up, you know, doing things to themselves. Yeah. It's very distressing, you know, and I feel so sad about that. Like, even when I was writing my book, I remember seeing some children, you know, they'd come out of school and they went straight to the kebab shop and the famous burger bar and stuff. And I think, my God, you know, we had to come straight home after school and, you know, and we'd have mums cooking whether you like it or not, you know, and we didn't have all this going to places and filling up before you even got home. Or maybe the parents want them to fill up because they can't be bothered to cook, who knows, because they haven't, it's everything's so expensive.
I think in modern society now, what I'm noticing with coaching is that the adherence is the worst it's ever been.
Yes,
because I think that we're our capacity is just, it's so short,
yeah,
and we just don't have time to commit to the process
of exactly
achieving something.
Yes, exactly.
It's too long, it's too far away, like 12 weeks to something, or 6 months to something. It's just too long, and I'm noticing that more now than ever. And it's things like TikTok, YouTube, shorts, and it's just access, go, and we're so knowledgeable about so many different things and we're not experts in anything.
No, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
sound like a GP there. That's all we are. Yeah. Jack of all trades.
Yeah. I think that is something that we've got to get a handle on pretty quick.
We do.
And I worry about my kids.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. It is a worry. It really is. How can you protect them from this? You know, and the thing is, it's we need some regulation to come in. You know, because the thing is, you know, when we were younger, it was all about us, because it's the ego, isn't it? You're living in the ego. Like when I fell in love, I thought, mum and dad, I've never experienced this before. You know, and heartbreak, I thought, no one's ever experienced this before. And, you know, and you just think it's all about you. And then as you grow older, you see that actually we're all in it together. And it's like a phenomenal realization that you are not by yourself. But when you're by yourself, you're very ambitious, you know, sort of just trying to maintain, and you know, your regality almost in a way. And I think that's the thing. And I think it is very hard with children now, because I think you almost losing, you know, like when mum and dad, when we were little, if we were in our bedroom, then mum and dad knew we were home safe. But you could have your children up in the bedroom, but you don't know what they're doing, you know, like what they're.
What
yeah, exactly.
To, yeah.
So it's very difficult. And then if you try and stop that, then they get angry. Yeah. and they'll express their anger to you.
Rebel,
yeah. Probably. And the thing is also, I think it's also the society we're living in now. You know, I remember if I liked a dress, the dress would be in the shop for quite a long time and I'd save up for it to get it. But now, oh, I like that. Click. Amazon, you know, or whatever, you know, other jungles that exist will just bring it the next day, you know, and you're thinking, oh, yeah. And then you don't sometimes even take the price tag off. You haven't got time because you're looking at the next thing and stuff, you know. So it's a very busy world, you know, and I have to almost pull back and think, right, I just need to focus on me and my self-nurturing. And I think that's another thing that's perceived as being selfish, but your self-care is quintessential to you existing as a human being, because like even when you're on a plane, the first thing they say is in the, you see the air hostess vibe is coming out again in the plane, the oxygen capacity goes down, you put the mask on yourself first before you put it on your kid. Because otherwise you can't help them, because it's really interesting, that concept, and the fact that looking after yourself is so important.
Some people struggle with that concept, don't they?
Yes. Well, I struggled with it until I got cancer, you know. I did.
Like, you know, I've had this discussion with my wife, my lovely wife, Jess.
Yeah.
but she sometimes, a lot of times she'll put our daughter Bodhi first.
Yes, yes.
But then she'll then fall backwards and start maybe struggling with stress. And
she's,
you know, we're not looking after herself.
Yes.
But it's that motherly instinct to always, you know,
the parental instinct
to be looking after them, but it's so important to look after yourself.
Have to, because otherwise you can't be a good parent. If you start to become stressed, the child picks up on that and then they'll start to develop that. So you have to change your personality to change your personal reality. And I think when Joe Dispenza said that, I thought, wow, that is, because he's a neuroscientist, but he's also into spirituality. So he has got the best, he's studied for about 25, 30 years, and it's phenomenal. You know, like, wow, that makes so much sense.
Do you have, there's like a platform on, you know, like Netflix and Amazon, there's one called Gaia.
Yes, I've already got that as well. Yeah.
Joe Dispenza's has actually got a lot of
work there. Well, my friend who expressed anger, we talked a lot about it, and he's the one who got me into Joe, and I haven't heard from him for about 15 years, but he suddenly, when he found out what I'd been going through, he came immediately and texted me and said, right, I need to help you. I've been sent to you to do the last bit of your healing journey. And I went, oh, and he says, have you heard of Joe? And I said, no. And he says, well, you've got to listen to this. He says, because you're there, but you're not quite there. And then the most amazing thing was, I said, now you've got to take your advice for yourself, you know, and let's let out our anger and let's let go of it so we can properly heal, you know. And it's interesting because, like, for example, I've got a friend who's got a lot of guilt. You know, she's a girl. She's got a lot of guilt, and she's kept that repressed, and that affects her big style. And it's interesting because I think, you know, but she's quite masculine in a way of being. So I just, interesting correlation there, that I'm repressing anger, which is a very masculine energy, you know. You know, everybody gets angry, but it's very much a masculine, you know, like in the forest, you know, sort of thing. While guilt is more a feminine energy, and she's very masculine in the way she's being. So it's almost like we've repressed our other side. So I've become too feminine, you know, like, oh, it's okay, submissive, I'll repress my anger. Submissive, And while she will, you know, kick ass, you know, she'll just say things to people. I think, oh my God, I can't believe you just said that, you know. But the thing is, then she gets the guilt, because then people say, well, how dare you say that to me? And then she'll feel guilty. But the thing is, it's very interesting, because that's feminine emotion, but she's very masculine. It's almost like, I wish she'd been born a boy, you know. If I was a boy, you know, DJ Fives coming. But that's what, you know, and I can see that. So that's an interesting concept, because females do, we multitask, you know. Men are from Venus and women are from Mars, or wherever they say, but it's true, because women can multitask. So, you know, Kendi might be doing something, but somebody says, she'll say, oh yeah, I'll do that as well, and we can. But men are very much compartmentalized in the way they think. So when they're doing their work, they don't want someone coming and say, oh, do you think the dress looks nice, what do you want for tea? They just want to be in that zone, and then, okay, now I'm in the zone of family life. And that is quite a marked thing. And that's what, like, my friend is very much compartmentalized in a way of thinking, well, and I'll be like, yeah, I'll do this and I'll do that. Flowing, you know.
So it's understanding yourself ultimately.
It is.
I think from what I'm getting from that is you have to spend more time on your own. Figure yourself out.
Yes.
And to meditate and to ask yourself questions.
Yes.
I take myself on dates all the time.
I
have a little date with myself and I go and sit down in my own mind. I have a coffee and I think about everything that I'm doing or not doing and
forget about that, darling. I'm going on a hot date with myself next Wednesday. I'm taking myself to see Moulin Rouge. Because all my friends said, that's amazing. And they said, make sure you get a good seat series. I've got like a mediocre. I thought, yeah, it's my birthday month. I'm going to go. And I love going on a hot date with myself because I think the person, you have to love yourself. And the person that will love you the most is yourself if you let it. Yeah. And it is the most beautiful thing to have this amazing body and just to be in love with it, because it is, it's a phenomenal, I mean, look how many activities we do. We can articulate, say a story, think, react, and create. I mean, the film directors, the DJs, all of you guys, you know, it's phenomenal. Yeah. You know, we all have a skill. And that's the thing. I think the problem with society is it has a hierarchy, and that's wrong. You know, like my father taught me, Sumi, probably the most important person on the ward is the nurse. You listen to her, you know. And he said the healthcare assistant. When I was ill, I relied on my healthcare assistants. They're the ones who bathed me when I couldn't move, you know, and I was so grateful to them. The dinner lady, I loved her. She gave me my food, you know. If she didn't give me my food, I wouldn't get better. The nurses, you know, they'd come and give me my antiemetics to stop me being sick. They were my true heroes. And initially they were a bit like skeptical because I was a doctor. They didn't want to kind of come into the, because, you know, they want, yeah. And I said, please guys, treat me like one of, you know, I see everybody's equal. You know, I don't see anybody high. It's just that we've been trained. We've had different opportunities, different luck, you know, and what we've made the most of what we've been given and we've trained or whatever, but we've just got different knowledge. No one has a hierarchy, but the problem is that the hierarchy exists in society, and this makes me mad. And I'm expressing that anger, but it does. You know, we're all equal, we're all humans, we've all got two eyes, nose and a mouth. Doesn't matter what colour we are, we're all the same, you know, and we're just all fruit, but we're very different fruit. That's basically it. You know, we are fruit.
That's such a nice way to look at it,
isn't it? Yeah, nice. There's an important one that I want to ask you. I know we're close to wrapping it up, but this one I feel is really important. For somebody who's so intuitive and knowledgeable about health
and the
whole globe and the spectrum of health, what are your thoughts on the fitness industry when it comes to things like that?
I think the fitness, it depends really how you look at it, because there are people out there like you, who want to really help people in the sense of you really try and look at them and tailor a program for them. But the thing is, it's like my friends have set up a charity called YoGift, because they say the problem is yoga has come over from the East to the West, and what's happened is it's become very westernized. So for example, you've got all the posh shops selling all the yoga gear and everything, and the thing is, yoga is actually an eight-limbed practice. You know, I'm talking about fitness from my yoga perspective. It's an eight-limbed practice where it talks about being kind to people. That's one of the limbs. It talks about being dutiful with yourself, respect to people. It talks about the asanas, which are the physical postures that the West uses, and it talks about breath work, which is another limb which we use as well. But then it's got all the other limbs about how you have to meditate, and how eventually you'll reach a place of peace. And these are all part of the yoga, but the thing is, the yoga journey has been cut down into physical practice and the breath work, which is very important, as you know with breathing. But because of that, it's kind of lost a lot of its essence, you know, and
commercialized.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. It has become commercial. So when fitness has become commercialized, when it's for gain, like, oh yes, take these supplements, do this, do that, you know. And again, we talked about Ayurveda, which is the foundation, the fact that we're all different constitutions. But the thing is, I think the fitness industry could really improve by just learning about how different constitutions have to have different kind of exercise routines and regimens, because it can make such a big difference. I honestly used to think running was so good for me, but it made me so anxious because it exacerbated my elements. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that's why I love Ayurveda, because it really tailors your exercise, the way you think, what you should eat, how you should sleep, mm-hmm. how you should work, what all of this kind of stuff. And I think the problem is there is a lot of fitness. I mean, obviously, I don't know much about the fitness industry, but I know that there will be lots of different ways of doing things. But the thing is, if you are doing, you know, if you're giving somebody exercises and HIIT training, which is not, it can make them quite ill because their body is not supposed to be doing that. Does that make sense? Yeah. Mm. And I think I didn't realize that. And I've realized, like for example, for breast cancer, they say that you should do moderate exercise, moderate walking. So that's what I do. I will always walk every day for at least 3 miles, you know, and that's my moderate, because that will reduce your risk of recurrence by 33%. You know, it's a phenomenal amount.
Just by walking.
Yeah, just by walking. And then I had a lady come to see me and she was really stressed. She was saying, oh, you know, they're saying that if they're going to give me the radiotherapy, there's a 5% reduction. I said, well, while you're thinking about that, darling, he says, why don't you just go for a walk? Because you'll reduce it by 33% for starters, you know. So it's putting everything into context and stuff. I was given a complimentary 12-week exercise program with my radiotherapy and everything. But I told her what I do, like I do yoga, I do kundalini, I do ashtanga yoga. I'm trained in ashtanga yoga. And then I said, then I do my breath work and then I do my meditation and then I do all of this. And she said, I haven't got anything to say to you because you're doing everything. Like for example, with kundalini yoga, when we're opening a heart center, we do what we call the bear grip. So I'm basically interlocking my fingers with my elbows outstretched and I pull. And you can pull as hard as you want and you won't hurt yourself because you're using your resistance and it's like really strong. You know, I'm like pulling, I'm really pulling as hard as I can. And then you breathe at the same time. So that's energizing. And I feel the difference. I feel if I haven't done my yoga, I don't feel right in the morning. It's phenomenal. Mm-hmm. But you have to learn. I think you have to have someone who's very empathic to somebody's what they feel, because intuitively that person will know what is good for them. And because when they might do HIIT, they might feel just really ill afterwards and then this is just awful, but everyone's doing it on Instagram, so I better do it too. Yeah. And that's the problem. It's been swayed by others, like that experiment I told you. And just one last thing I want to tell you about the mind is that just before ethics came into action, they apparently, one of the professors in my integrative medicine journey was talking about it, and he said there was a very interesting study they did before ethics came in where they looked at prisoners on, you know, because in America, they're on capital punishment in some states and they have the electric chair as their final sort of destination. But they said they offered some prisoners another way of dying. And they said, we can offer you bleeding to death. And some prisoners were like, I really don't want the electric chair. I'd rather have that. And they said, so what exactly happens? They said, well, we're going to slit your wrist and then you'll bleed. But because you'll be very slowly, because it's going to be a little slit, and then by the third day, you'll be dead, sort of thing. And they said, oh, okay, we'll go for that. You've got no choice. Devil in the deep blue sea. So anyway, so they got the prisoner when it came to their turn to pass, and they slit their wrist, and then the prisoner heard the dripping. But unknown to the prisoner, they did not slit the wrist, and the drip was a tap. But sure enough, after 3 days, they died.
Oh, wow.
When they've heard the last drop, they just died because their body had got ready
for death.
Yeah, I'd accepted that's what's going to happen.
It's the power of the mind.
That is how powerful the mind is. And to me, when they said that story, I thought, again, what Yorkshire, blooming heck. But it was. I was like, what on earth? You know, I mean, obviously, they wouldn't be able to do that now. But I mean, I thought, wow, that shows you. And that's when people talk about the placebo effect. I mean, they've had like when they used to do Horizon, which is like panorama, they did that thing with the cyclists where they got 7 cyclists on each team and they said, we're giving one like caffeine, which is going to make you go really fast, and they're going to give one just plain sugar pills. And what they found was that one that they're giving caffeine went really fast. They made extra 10 seconds on the circuit, like 10 seconds less than the other group. But then when it came to it, they all had exactly the same sugar pills.
Yeah.
But they really believed, yeah. They really believed it, yeah.
That's the thing, it's the belief.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
It
really when is. You know, they've given my prognosis and everything because I had to take early retirement on the basis of ill health, and a letter of the prognosis was sent to me. I have no idea about my prognosis. I have just not even read it because if you read it, the brain's going to be like, right, got to get ready. This is the time it's going to happen. Yeah. I have no idea. As far as I'm concerned, I'm like everybody else. Mm. You know, we're all terminal. So at the end of the day,
you're all walking a tightrope. Yeah, I say that all the time.
Exactly. But really, how amazing, what a gift I've been given that I can be released from that thing that I was in, you know, but use my knowledge now in a way that I can empower people.
And your belief.
And my belief, yeah, and help people. And the fact that I'm very lucky, I've been fortunate to do these various educational sort of standpoints along my timeline, but the fact that I can be now practicing it, that's phenomenal. You know, like, you can talk as a professor, oh, this, that, the other. But the fact that I'm living it, you know, I was supposed to be dead 2 years ago in 2021. They gave me a terminal diagnosis. They got palliative care team involved. They got hospice at home team involved. I remember sitting there thinking, this doesn't sound very good. Mm. And then they said, we'll get the Hindu chaplain to come and see you. We'll try and get you home and we'll get you palliative care. Let's get the end of life pathway initiated. That's what they did. And I sat there and my friend Jamie, who was my yoga teacher, is wonderful, a real friend. He actually gave up his job to come into the hospital during COVID to make me soup, you know, and amazing Hippocrates soup, ironically. It's amazing because, and my friend Diane as well, they were allowed in because I was dying. So they allowed them in during COVID. And obviously my sister would come at the weekend because she was still doing her work, bless her. But what I'm saying is that Jamie said, so what we're going to do, because the doctor came, right, I'm sorry, your scan, it's terrible. You've got cancer spread all over your brain, all over your lungs, all over your kidneys, and it's got it in your spine. And, you know, sorry. Here's some steroids, take that, you know, sort of thing. And I thought, this is not good. and I just sat there thinking about it. And I thought, but the human body is amazing. And I have belief that, and I had no fear, you see, because by that point I was so ill, I'd gone in. I'd actually asked my father passed away. And I had his picture next to my bed. And I said, you know, Dad, I said, I think I'm dying, you know, but it's COVID. No one's going to take me seriously. And, you know, but, do you know what, Dad? I'm not scared anymore. You know, I'm going to actually give you the reins of my car and you can drive it now and you can be responsible for me now. Because if I'm dying, I don't mind, because then I'll meet you in heaven and we can go traveling, because we used to love traveling. We went to Tibet and all these amazing places. But if I'm supposed to live because I have a purpose, a life purpose, then you'll do that for me. But I don't care anymore. I'm quite chilled out because being in COVID is horrible. I live alone. I can't see my friends. I'm just trying to pacify my patients. I'm still working full time. And this is just an awful existence. And I don't want to be here anymore. This is just awful. You know, they're scaring people on the media and all this kind of stuff. And I'm having to pacify all my patients, you know, and I can't prescribe homeopathy. Then, but it would be brilliant if I could, because that would be an amazing thing, because that's brilliant for pandemics. But then I just thought to myself, yeah, I have no fear. And that's the other thing, to have a strong mind and no fear and just believe in the process of your life. Your life is already mapped out for you. You actually chose to come back to this life and experience what you are. We're just amazing spirits in a body form. So yeah, I've got these scars. Yes, I've got a mastectomy scar. I've got my scar. But this is just a body. The actual essence of you is inside, you know, and that is what comes out when you talk to people, their energy. You can feel it, you know. And, you know, like, you can almost fall in love with somebody and they might not be what you expect. And people say, how can they be going together? But it's that person has seen beyond what, because that look will disappear eventually. You know, it's the essence of what that person is, and you've got it inside of you. Like with yoga, for example, I say to people, if you do yoga or the breathing, you've got an internal pharmacy. You've got one that releases dopamine, serotonin, and chemicals to heal, all of that kind of stuff. It's just phenomenal. And what you eat, your nutrition is so important. All of these things, and this is what integrative medicine is. You know, we do all like a tree framework, and integrative medicine is a wellness model it's basically a health model underpinned by wellness, while our conventional medicine is a health model underpinned by illness, and that's the difference. Yeah. And I think if you can, in conventional medicine, we just look at the bark, the leaves, the branches and the leaves, and then chop bits off. I've got infected and the bark gets all infected. But if you're a truly a holistic doctor, you'd be looking at the soil and the roots, because it's what's happening down there that will create prevention. The eventual thing.
Nice. Mm. Final question, Sumi. Yes. Your book.
My book.
Yeah, book. Let's talk about the book.
The book.
Is it ready? And do you have a title?
I'm changing the title. You might be able to help me here, guys. Basically, I started to write my book as soon as I came out of hospital. I was in there for seven weeks, and they just didn't think, as you know, I was end of life and all that kind of stuff. But when I came out of hospital, I just thought, I have to write this down. And at that moment, you're high on steroids. So you're kind of a bit, woohoo, you know. And everyone said, no, don't say anything to anybody, or don't start to criticize anybody, because you're high on steroids and you might say something wrong, you know. I thought, okay. But you are high on steroids. So I was writing away, but it wasn't me. And my energy healer so happened to have a journalist on her thing. So she said, why don't we have her as a ghostwriter to help you write your book? So it was really good, because I couldn't really write much or type, because I was still, you know, recovering. So she wrote all the stuff, but it was very kind of not my writing style, because I'm quite an artist and I like to use poetry and quotes and stuff like that, and inspirational things, because you can say something really powerfully to somebody just by two lines, as opposed to having to go through a whole essay. But anyway, so she got the gist of it. And then I basically then started to write it again, but I edited like what she was writing. But that took ages, because you started trying to fit it all in. And then I thought, no. And then I got better and better. And then I thought, no, that's not right. And then I wrote it again. And now it's flowing. Now it's me. Now it's my essay. And the thing is, I now know why I didn't finish the book, because it's still an ongoing process. Like this chapter is going to be massive, like my realizing this anger thing, because then I could try and I'm hoping to get to a point where I can inspire people. But I know the journey in itself is going to be inspirational, because
you're doing that already,
you know.
For sure.
But it's just that I have to do it my way, you know. And so initially I was going to call it, because I love Coldplay, when I got diagnosed in 2013, actually, I thought I was dying. And the first thought that came into my head was, oh my God, I didn't go and see Coldplay live. Damn. And then I went, I should have gone to the hairdresser more times, and thought, oh no, I've got to tell mum and dad. So that was the way the regrets came through. And I thought, that's pretty good, you know, that I've obviously travelled enough to be happy with that and no regrets. And my regret is not to see Coldplay live. So I've seen them twice now, and they're brilliant. And I love Chris Martin. I wish he was available. But anyway.
Come on, Chris.
But so I was initially going to call it Coldplay and Chemo, because I'm on oral chemo now, and I think I'm on my 37th cycle. And I was popping my chemo while I was going, yay, you know, living, we are the universe, and all that kind of stuff. And then some of my friends said, Sumi, some people won't know Coldplay, who he is. And I said, how can you not know who Coldplay is? That's like a fallacy, you know. And then I thought, maybe I should call it, the doctor who, you know, I just saw some boring title or something, like, I don't know,
just
something
to try,
like,
grab some attention.
Yes, and a doctor's cancer odyssey, you know, or whatever. And then one of my friends said, one of my doctor friends, I was quite surprised. He said, you know, Sumi, you are actually a healer. And I said, the doctor who became a healer, yeah. But then I've had another thought, and I was telling my amazing Indian Shampisaj massage guy, he's like gives you a massage, but it's like psychotherapy massage. he can feel things in your body, and he tells you, it's just, you had a hard childhood, didn't you? Or this thing, and I think, wow, how does he know that? It's like me saying, you know, like doing your Ayurvedic profile, you think, oh, you know, do you know these things? But he said... I said, I always wanted to be an air hostess. And he says, well, you are. And I said, what do you mean? And he says, you are a spiritual air hostess because you're taking people from one destination to another with love and care. Whoa. And I thought, yeah, that's nice. You know, but I don't know how I'm going to title it, like a spiritual air hostess. People think, what the hell? And like a doctor's personal cancer odyssey or something like that. Mm. But I thought, yeah. That is what I am. I am a spiritual air hostess. Isn't that lovely?
Nice. Yeah, I like that.
That's cool.
That's better than cold playing chemo, huh?
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. But I think I want to finish with a quote because you love your quotes.
Yeah.
And I love this quote. My friend sent me this. And it says, the devil whispered in my ear, you cannot withstand the storm. Today I whispered in the devil's ear, I am the storm.
Yeah.
Gives me... goosebumps,
yeah,
when I say that.
Yeah.
But it's true.
It's empowering.
Yeah. But we are, guys. Mm. You have to live in the question as opposed to live in the answer. And that's what I did. Mm. You know, I was given a diagnosis and basically poor prognosis, told to be that I had to be on DNR because I didn't want to be a burden to my family, be disabled or anything like that. But then Jamie said, what about living in the question? I said, yeah. I've got nothing to lose. I'm going to live in the question. I'm going to see. I'm going to be a scientist. I don't need any ethics to trial my own body. Let's see what the body can do if you put it in its right mindset. I had no fear. And I was that close to death, guys, that I actually saw the other side, and it was phenomenal. It's nothing to be scared of. And this is what I put in my book about death, because it was beautiful, and it was pulling me in, and I just wanted to go. You know, I thought, oh, this is great. You know, I'm not sure whether you've seen the film Ghost, but it was just like that. It was really good. And actually, I thought, wow, is this just me because I've seen Ghost? I'm seeing this. Yeah. But it felt so real. And I actually had to feel myself being pulled back because I thought, no, Dad's let me live because I've got to do a purpose. And when I told that to my dad, my best friend came and visited. She just said, I'm worried about you, Sumi. I'm going to come. And I said, no, don't bother. She said, no, I'm going to come. And obviously, Dad, he wanted me to live, you know. And when I, my energy healer told me. Yeah, it's, and when I know my dad is there, yeah, it is, and I have to do this, you know, and I'm just following that process, and you know, and I'm making it. It's real because you can see the scars. You can see that I lost my hair; it's growing back now, you know. And I'm like, because I'm a Leo, so my mane is really important to me. But it is phenomenal what I've learned about the human body. I mean, I can't wait to share it with people. And people will say, "Oh, well, there's some expensive treatments in there." And I think, no, you can start basic nutrition. If you can get your nutrition right, that is gold, because that is the fuel you're putting in your engine, really. And that would be an amazing thing to do. So it's just been an amazing, phenomenal journey. And I thought that my experience was very unique. But then my energy healer told me to read the book by Anita Monjali, great title, Dying to Be Me. And she, if you get a chance, really read that book, because she talks about being end of life and being in a coma and all that kind of stuff. And everybody was panicking around her, but she was quite calm with herself, and she survived. And she had the same, she articulated in words what I saw, the vision of the other side. And it's phenomenal, guys, because you're all in it, all past souls, everything. But it's like, because we're all together, you know, when we realize that, then it's not scary anymore.
Nice.
That's empowering.
Amen. Yeah.
Again.
Yeah.
The whole theme of what you've been talking about is all very empowering.
Yeah.
Just a reminder that the power is within.
Yes, it is. It is. And if I can affect one person's way of thinking, then I've done a great job. You know, that's all I want. And then that. Yeah. Well, there you go. I've done my job. I'm going to go home now.
That's to the sun and back 150 times.
150
so that's how powerful that is.
Times. Can you believe? Yeah. I still can't get over that. 150 times.
That's madness.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah,
it really
that
is.
That is amazing. And your body, I think, has about 8 litres of blood going around. And I think it goes around the lungs about 60 times in a minute. You know, that's how quick. Mm. It's just because it's trying to oxygenate, and it's phenomenal. How many times a day can you imagine? Our bodies are amazing, guys, really. And I think when you first start to really fall, and you fall head over heels. And this is a love that won't let you down. It's there for you, you know. It won't say, no, I like somebody else. It's there for you. It's just all there. You just have to access it. All this genetic material that's never used to get. And people, I think, like Nelson Mandela, like Gandhi, like Lincoln, all of these people had that. They knew that. They manifested that because they used all their genetic potential to get where they did. Because I think like people like Nelson Mandela are just amazing. Yeah. That he's in prison for 13 years and he still came out with so much love and forgiveness because he changed the way he thought and he used different parts of his genetic material to form a new circuit to respond to people in a different way.
Yeah, amen to that one. Mm. That's something we can all learn from, isn't it? For sure. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Sumi.
Dr. Sumi.
Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.